Hello, everybody. I'm Deirdre Griffiths from Villamanta Disability Rights Legal Service. Thank you for coming to this session. We're just waiting for one of our presenters, who'll be here momentarily. I think you know from the program that we're looking at how advocates, particularly legal advocates and other advocates who work with the legal advocates, have been trying to use the law in a couple of different examples. And one is the work that Villamanta Disability Rights Legal Service did in conjunction with VALID in relation to the fee hike campaign. And I guess a lot of you would be aware of that. And the other, and Viv Avery from Villamanta Disability Rights Legal Service is going to talk about that. And the other is the BSWAT campaign and legal matter that AED Legal Service has been involved in, and Kirsty Wilson from AED Legal Service will be talking about that. And I'm not sure whether our speakers would like you to ask questions as you go along. Yes, I know Viv Avery is happy to have people ask questions, interrupt and ask questions. And Kirsty, do you like, is that okay with you too? Yes, or, you know, if you'd like to save questions till the end, that would be fine too. And I guess we're interested in hearing from the speakers about how they used the law, how they ran these campaigns, and what success or otherwise they had in the various tribunals, courts, legal forum settings that they worked in. And I might introduce the first presenter, Viv Avery from Villamanta Disability Rights Legal Service, and hand over to Viv. Viv is one of our lawyers who works on disability-related legal issues for our clients who have a disability and a disability-related legal issue. And some of the areas Villamanta works in are a little bit to do with, a lot to do with disability services and access to services, but also other general rights matters for people who have a disability and justice matters. We do some work on child protection matters, in particular for parents who have a disability and who become embroiled in the child protection system. And we do work on guardianship and administration and a little bit on criminal law and related issues, and just quite a variety of different areas that affect our clients. So I'll introduce Viv Avery and hand over to Viv. And yes, please feel free to ask questions as we go along and just put your hands up and we'll get the roving mic to you. Thank you.
Right, g'day. My name's Viv Avery, and I'm not sure if you can hear me. Can you hear me out the back? Can you hear me up the back? You can now. It's really great. I had a headmaster many years ago who said, put your hand up if you can't hear me at the back. And, of course, nobody could, but there we are. There is a PowerPoint presentation that is supposed to be running, but I don't know how to access it. I'm sorry. So you're just going to have me talking while we find the InfoTech person to start the PowerPoint. Yuck. Now, Villamanta... 6 or 7 months ago, we were contacted by quite a number of parents who were concerned that they were getting letters from the Department of Human Services to raise the rent of people living in what are called CIUs or disability service accommodation units. What the government, state government, wanted to do was raise the rent to 75% of the pension plus the Commonwealth rent assistance. Now, for many people, of course, that was a huge increase in their rent. We've got somebody? Brilliant. That was a huge increase in their rent. And it meant for a lot of people that they weren't going to be able to access a lot of services. So. Real change or short change? That's me.
That's the clicker here as well.
That's the clicker. Thank you. Gotcha. Thanks. Right. Now, the significant issue for people with who we were dealing with was that they were significantly disadvantaged. They were probably the most disadvantaged people of our community, and that's saying something to a group of people who advocate for people with disabilities. The biggest problem for this client group was that they were living in disability service accommodation units. They're often profoundly disabled. They have the same rights as everybody else, but they're often unable to advocate for their own rights. The question, therefore, was it fair to raise the rent to 75% of the pension plus the Commonwealth rent assistance? And that was the question that we were asked. As lawyers, of course, the question wasn't, was it fair? In fact, we weren't really caring about whether it was fair. We were more interested in whether or not it was correct in the legal sense. Now, we've been asked to talk here about systemic change. Now, the issue about systemic change is there are essentially three areas that encompass or can engage systemic change. You need to have a change in the political attitudes. Let's not go down the line of bagging the Liberal Party at this point in time. You have to have a change in the social awareness, and that's exceedingly important. And you have to have an understanding that there needs to be a change often in the legal process. We'll come back to those three areas as we go. But importantly, what we were asked to do, as I said, we were asked to look at the decision to raise the rent. The vulnerability of this client group is in many ways very, very important, not necessarily from a legal sense, but from the social sense. The reason that the issue of vulnerability was important was because these people just simply can't advocate for themselves. They often have families who are not able to care for the client at home. We'll call them a client or a resident. We won't call them a person with a disability because actually I hate that term. It's to me a term which creates a disadvantage, whereas at Villamanta Legal Service we like to try to ensure that all people are treated with equal dignity. They are the most vulnerable people. They're often put in the homes because their parents can no longer look after them. A large proportion of the people that rang Villamanta, and there were hundreds of phone calls, were from families who were saying, I'm aged, I'm 70, I'm 80 years of age, I can't advocate, I haven't got the strength to advocate for my children anymore. We got phone calls from organisations that said this person has no person to advocate for them. A large proportion of these people are on administration orders with state trustees or with Judge and Papaleo. And with respect to state trustees and Judge and Papaleo, they don't advocate for the client on an individual basis. So because these people couldn't stand up for themselves, because they couldn't say anything, the fairness issue which was raised by the social side of this argument was that these people can't argue against it. So the issue about the vulnerability, of course, is the most important one is people have a right to be part of the community. The increasing of the rent meant that a lot of people would then be unable to access the community. They couldn't do the things like pay for their day placements. They couldn't go and buy cups of coffee for their family. That was actually one example of a person who rang us up and said, I can't afford to be able to pay for a cup of coffee for my mum and dad to come over. They couldn't afford to buy presents for Christmas. They couldn't afford to catch a bus or buy their own clothes. The system before what the state government had was actually a very good system. It showed where their money was going. It showed it was open. It was accessible. And it was, for people living in community residential services, it showed them where their money went. One of the arguments we got back was, well, they don't understand, so why does it matter? Which, from my perspective, was one which raised my hackles very quickly. But it was an attitude of government, it was an attitude of the Department of Human Services, that just because people with intellectual disabilities, and that's the main area, just because they may not be able to understand, doesn't mean that they shouldn't have that information available to them just in case. Or perhaps just in case that 90% of them would have some understanding, or just in case 90 to 95% of them would like to have the dignity of having that information available to them. I said earlier on that fairness wasn't an issue because I'm a lawyer, but fairness is a significant issue because you feel constrained or angered by the department's and by the state government's attitude about people with disabilities. what their program was simply to take 75% of the pension and ensure that that money was put towards accommodation. It did not take into account the difference in services. There were some houses in the disability sector where the gutters are falling off, the rooms have not been painted, there's urine smell across the house, there is an appalling food that's being provided. Compare that to a service which was brand new, which had a lovely home, which had individual rooms, which was properly carpeted, and which had good food for the individuals. What the government was seeking to do was to charge somebody the same figure for different services. A crap service, a quality service, and the government wanted to charge the same figure. And for us, that's where the law stepped in. As I said, families were horrified. Organisations such as Valid were wanting to jump in. But we were told that we had no legal argument. We were told we had no legal argument by the Office of the Public Advocate. We were told we had no legal argument by the Department of Human Services. We were told we had no legal argument by the other legal services that assisted us. And we were told we had no legal argument whatsoever by actually a lecturer from university. However, I disagreed. The important thing here, from the legal perspective, is that we had to take away that emotive issue and look at the law. And when we talk about the different types of campaigns, we need to understand that there are three different campaigns. There is a social campaign, the legal campaign, and the political campaign. So that's where we get back to these issues. The social campaign was run by Valid. Now, Valid did an absolutely excellent job. What they did was they chased around for signatures. They organised rallies at Parliament. They contacted the radio, the papers and the television, and they attended Parliament. They got representatives to go and attend Parliament. All of this was designed to put pressure on the Liberal government at the time. They even spoke to the member from Frankston, hoping to get him on board, which actually wasn't very successful, but then we all know what the Liberal member from Frankston's like. The legal campaign, what we did was we lodged an application at VCAT. Now, just be clear on this, this was the first ever legal campaign, the first ever application about rent in disability service accommodation units. We started off with 100 or so clients from 100 or so families. We ended up with 1,800 clients. 1,800 clients that we had to advocate for, that we had to find legal action for, legal argument for. What was interesting was that when we got into VCAT, into court, we were up against, the department actually hired a QC. And in fact, the gentleman was more than a QC. He was a Don from Oxford University. He was a QC from the UK, a senior counsel in Australia, and he appeared for the Royal Commission on Fires. They had me, sorry about that, to act. We argued that when we look at systemic change, we need to be aware that there are those three elements. And from the legal point of view, we actually argued that the increase itself was inconsistent with the Disability Act. It was arbitrary, and that's Wensbury's rule, and I'll tell you what that is in a minute because you'll love that. Well, I do because I'm a lawyer. But the department said it wasn't excessive because excessive was defined in the Act. Well, we said we don't care. What Wensbury's rule is it's a rule made in the 1800s, and it was a case which a member of Parliament made a decision, and the court said that it's a decision that no reasonable person in their right mind would make. And this is the argument that we presented in part in court or in the tribunal. Essentially, we said that the increase, because it was across the board, because it didn't take into account all the individual factors of people, then that was an unreasonable decision. It was unreasonable because why would you be paying 75% if all you're getting is bread and butter in the morning? Why would you be paying 75% if your room hasn't been painted for the last 10 years and smells of urine? Why would you be paying 75% if your money was taken away and you couldn't then attend your day placements? Those might seem like factual arguments, but they're actually part of the legal argument. The interesting thing is that this is what the government did. The government said, well, yeah, you've got a right to bring an application to VCAT, but VCAT doesn't have the jurisdiction to hear the matter. Okay, so that I noticed some raised eyebrows when I said that. That is precisely the argument of the government. You can bring the matter to VCAT, but VCAT can't hear it. And what that meant was that we had to argue what's called a jurisdictional argument. This was a day and a half of legal argument in front of a county court judge who was assigned to the case. And VCAT ruled in our favour. VCAT said, well, yes, the argument that the Villamanta is seeking is actually a valid argument because the Act does allow for the matter to be heard at VCAT. Now, just note that. We actually haven't got to the substantive argument yet. The department, as I said, had hired a QC. They had spent thousands upon thousands of dollars to argue a point which was simply about whether or not VCAT had jurisdiction to hear, whether VCAT could hear the matter. We won the argument, and what the department then did was I'll flick through this quite quickly. They lost. They said, oh, well, VCAT does have a right to hear it, so we're actually not going to pursue the case. So the department withdrew simply on the basis that VCAT could hear the case. As I say, this is the legal side, not the social side, not the political side. Because they withdrew because they knew we would win. We had thousands upon thousands of signatures. We had thousands and thousands of people who were ringing in to say the action was wrong. We had people turn up, family members, mums, dads, turn up at the VCAT hearing and voice their concern about the decision that the department had made. That was even before we got to the substantive case, the actual case. We started preparing for the actual case before the department withdrew, and we had huge amounts of information to show why the decision was irrational and Wensbury's rule, one which no reasonable person in their right mind would make. What the department then said, or what the minister then said, let's be very clear about what the minister said. We had 1,800 clients. The minister said, we don't want to put them through a case. We don't want to put them through a hearing because that would be upsetting for them. Condescending point of view. These people turned up at VCAT. They wanted to fight, and the government simply tried to save face by saying, well, we don't want to put them to bit of hardship. We don't want to put them through a legal case. The department then decided to change the law. And this is where we get to the question, was it real change or not? In changing the law, what the department didn't do was that the government didn't do was they didn't demand 75% of the person's pension. They still wanted the Commonwealth Rent Assistance, but then most people weren't getting that anyway. What they then said was we'll have a review of accommodation service costs and a review of the fees, and that's happening now. Now, what's happening at this point in time is that Valid is meeting with the opposition. What's happening at this time is Valid is organising further on with the advocacy. They are involved in the review process for the fees. They are still seeking public support for the program. So when we get back to the three issues, the question is, have we made a social awareness? And I think the answer to that is clearly we have. We got onto the radio. I was interviewed on the radio, and that went across quite well, apparently. Many other people were interviewed. We got into the newspapers, and we got the government to cave in because there was this social pressure upon them. The legal challenge. Did we make a difference in the legal challenge? And I think we did. We certainly stopped the 75%. Whether we stop it forever is a question that needs to be looked at in the future. We certainly stopped that 75% being taken away from people's pensions because there was the social campaign. Have we changed the political structure of the government? And the short answer there is no, we haven't. The government, in their attitude in walking away from the case, I must admit I was severely, incredibly disappointed not being able to run the case in VCAT, because it's a public campaign, it's a public case. It could have been across all the newspapers. The government ran away from that. They changed the law, albeit partially, but their attitudes haven't changed. Their attitude that a person needs to pay for whatever services they get is profoundly ludicrous, because people with intellectual disabilities living in accommodation services simply don't have the money to pay for everything they get. It needs to be subsidised. Their attitude that, well, they don't really need to know where their money is going, is again profoundly insulting, because what it means is that they're denying that person their rights to be treated as everyone else in society, with respect, with dignity, with the opportunity to be able to make their own decisions or to see where their money goes. Irrespective of whether the person is so profoundly disabled they don't understand, that's irrelevant. But the government hasn't changed their attitude. So the question at the very beginning was, did we make social or systemic change? I think we did make social change. We made it more aware. We certainly changed the legal issue. But sadly, I don't believe that we've changed the government's attitude. And that's the answer to the question. Now, just so there are some resources for you, there are a couple of resources for people considering social change, considering a program for social change. One is Deirdre. It is, I've got to do this bit because this is a publication by Villamant, by the way. And my boss is sitting out the front. There is a book called People.com in Unity. It's actually a really interesting book which talks about social campaigns and gives lots of examples about social campaigns. It's an excellent book to read, and I've got some free handouts for you later on. Sorry, Deirdre. Whatever. There is on the internet an absolutely brilliant resource kit called the Butterfly Toolkit. As you know, when a butterfly waves its wings in the Amazon, there'll be a hurricane in Papua New Guinea or something. That's where that idea comes from. But this campaign program is one which was run for a number of programs in Africa and a couple of other areas. And it talks about all the different social campaign strategies that you can use. Talk to the decision makers, make sure there's a political change, make sure there's social change, make sure there's legal change. Those campaign things are downloadable from the internet, and I'll make sure that you can get those links later on. So I know that I'm limited for time, and my problem is I like to talk for a long time. However, it's open up for questions. Anybody got any questions? Yes. Just wait for the mic.
Okay. Yeah, like I said before, you're doing really well what you say on the speech. And in the community around here, I reckon we serve a medal for you for standing up for everyone. And when I started, I've been in a few meetings making a lot of speeches on the stage once, and I went really well. And so thank you very much, mate, that speeches, and you've done really well.
Well, thanks for the feedback. That's brilliant. The Villamanta, by the way, is staffed by three lawyers. We're only all part-timers because the organisation, as we know, disability services are underfunded. But we do try and do the best we can, and thanks for the feedback. I'll pass it back to all the other lawyers.
Can we... I've sort of worked as a systemic advocate for a number of years, and I find that there's a lot of barriers, obviously. One of those, I guess, when you're looking at supported accommodation is whether it's this issue or something similar, the privacy issue, where people are experiencing something, whether it's a poor quality of service, and they complain to the commissioner. Is it possible for us to develop some sort of systemic register of complaints that is held, say, at Villamanta, that we can then forward on, so that we can say we have a lot of dissatisfaction in this area, and when things arise that it becomes a meeting place in terms of...
Okay, your question talked about privacy and a register. For those who heard the radio broadcast, I was asked a question on the radio, and my answer was, you're asking a lawyer a question? And the answer is yes, no, maybe. Lawyers should always answer questions, yes, no, maybe. So let's take them one at a time. I'm not sure what the issue of privacy has got to do with it, simply because if a register is formed and placed somewhere, then the information that is being provided to the register is relevant to the information that's being collected, or the use of it is relevant, and that's under the Privacy Act and the privacy regs. When you said privacy, my first thought was DHS often say there's a privacy issue here. With great respect, that's in more often than not crap. DHS will use the word privacy to not provide information which you actually have a right to, or the client has a right to access without having to go through freedom of information. Is the client living there? I'm their lawyer. We can't tell you because there's privacy issues. Is a client living there? I'm their father. Well, we can't tell you what they're doing because there's privacy issues. Sometimes we get that petty with privacy issues. So if you're dealing with, and this is the way I took the first part of the question, I'm sorry. Don't be dissuaded by the word privacy. It's not always relevant or accurate. In terms of a register, I think the register is actually a brilliant idea. A lot of people get injured or hurt, or there are incidents in a disability service accommodation units, or CRUs as they were called. The process for reporting those is probably inadequate, and I don't think that there is an audit trail for those to go, though there is a policy and procedure which does require the department to follow certain steps. That policy and procedure is or should be available on the internet, but sadly it's not always followed. And I just remember that after our discussion earlier. So that's something which you could probably research. Could Villamanta hold it? No, simply not, simply because it would be an issue which a government body or similar should manage that sort of register so that it could be followed through. The Disability Service Commissioner might be the most appropriate one. Who knows? But then you have to change the law to ensure that they can do that. Any other questions?
We might take one more question now quickly, and then we'll hand over to Kirsty Wilson from AED Legal Service. Otherwise, we'll run out of time and then have more questions at the end. So one last question for Viv.
I come from Sydney, and I've worked within group homes within Sydney.
Yes.
So, I mean, I don't know much around here at all, but when you're talking about change and the money side of things and how the guys can't, being able to access, can you guys, is there any way that your organisation could change that in any way, shape or form? Like, especially with the NDIS coming in, how is it going to affect what you're saying about the change and stuff like that?
Right, is your question that in New South Wales there isn't a transparent process for how the money's managed?
There is in New South Wales, but you're saying up here that there isn't because of what the change you were just talking about, how you're saying that 70% of their money is taken away and you had that big fight. So that's what I'm saying. Is there any way that with the NDIS, is that going to change at all in any way, shape or form? The question that you were just asking.
Okay. The way that the management of money was advocated for in Victoria was actually a very long process and involved a lot of families who argued that the person with the intellectual disability needs to be able to see where their money goes. And it goes down to how much food is purchased, where the furniture is purchased, what money is spent for clothing, and there is a ledger which shows all that information. That took years for that procedure to be put in place, simply from advocacy by organisations such as Valid and Parents. It's an absolutely brilliant system, and it's the one which the department and the government want to take away. And a lot of the money where it's kept is actually held on trust for the client. So it goes into a trust fund, which is then used to benefit the client. Again, that was something which the government was seeking in some part to take away. That's still a program. That is still something that I understand the government is still seeking to do, and something which families and Valid is seeking to advocate against that sort of change. That's the way it was done.
I might just have to cut you off there, Viv, And sorry if we haven't fully answered the questions, and if there are more questions, maybe we could have them after, or you could speak to the individual speakers around lunchtime. But thank you very much, Viv, for your presentation, and I'll invite Kirsty Wilson from AED Legal Service up. AED Legal Centre, sorry.
Hi, I also don't know how to work this thing, so we might need the IT tech man back again. Oh, here, somebody comes. Just to introduce myself, I'm Kirsty Wilson from AED Legal Centre. I'm the principal lawyer there. We're a community legal centre, especially or specifically for people with disability in the areas of employment and education. We're funded by the Department of Social Services, and there are at this stage... No, that's not mine. Sorry. I'm really not very good with this thing. So real change or shortchanged, a fight against the system. And the picture up there is of Tyson Duval Comrey, who is the applicant in the representative action that is going on at the moment, but I'll get to that. The rule of law. Our department has primary responsibility for supporting the Australian government in protecting and promoting the rule of law. The rule of law underpins the way Australian society is governed. Everyone, including citizens and the government, is bound by and entitled to the benefit of laws. We support the Australian government in being accountable for actions, making rational decisions, and protecting human rights. And I think our story goes to show that that's not what they do. Our story. Working for peanuts. Australia's shame. A journey through the legal system, 10 years later, it's actually 12 years later. And justice for all, I don't think so. I guess I've got cynical over the last 12 years in thinking, believing that, you know, we start off, we're recognising that there is a group of people who don't receive the same equality that those working in open employment receive. And I had hoped that in taking this action that we would actually get a result in the end that would achieve that. Australian Disability Enterprises. A lot of you would know them as sheltered workshops or business services. An ADE is supported employment. It's for people who may need some support to be able to go to work. They're funded by the Department of Social Services to give that support. And the employees attend and they do production or they might do gardening. There's a whole range of tasks that they do. 12 years ago, I realised that these people were being paid maybe 5 cents an hour, a dollar a day, a couple of dollars a week. And it wasn't based on awards, which is how most, well, it's how your wages are calculated working in open employment. And so we commenced the campaign. Now, well, what happened was that the government designed a tool that measured how much these workers should be paid. So in 2004, they introduced the Business Services Wage Assessment Tool. Now, this was despite being told quite clearly the tool is discriminatory. It's not fair. So what happened with this tool is that it's divided into two. Instead of just measuring how productive the employee was, only half was given to that side of the wage. The other part was in regards to competencies. So what would happen is that the employee would be asked questions such as, what meetings does your boss go to? What do you do if there's water on the floor? How do you go? What do you do if you don't get on with your neighbour? I mean, how relevant are these things to the work that you're actually doing? I was at one ADE where doing the assessment, and I noticed that my client had been marked as not yet competent, and yet she'd answered all the questions correctly. And they said to me, well, she obviously didn't understand the questions because we saw her pick up a piece of paper from the floor without bending her knees. She lost a percentage of her wage. And in fact, many of these employees lost half of their wages, because what happened is if you got one thing wrong, one question wrong, and so then, you know, OCHC Health and Safety, for example, 16 questions, you get one wrong, you got zero. You get 15 wrong, you got zero. And so you would lose that percentage of the competency section. In regards to what industry, some people only did, for example, gardening. The other three competencies in that section, they got zero for. So in what was happening here is that we had these employees, for example, say they're 50% productive, but they get zero for their competency. They ended up with 25% of the wage. We've got one of our clients who's on 33 cents an hour, $150 per annum. That's not per week. It's each year she received $150. So we had problems with this tool. We found that this tool was discriminatory. What happens with the question was the $150 per annum, was that on top of the DSP? Yes, it is on top of the DSP. It's no different to if you are working, you know, you're on New Start or on a sole parent, you're on whatever pension there might be, and you go and work, then the money you get is on top of the DSP or the pension, whatever pension you're on. You're allowed to earn about $80 a week before you're...
Up to 300 a week? 300
a week? No. It's around... Look, it's an approximate figure, but it's around $80 a week you're allowed to earn before your pension is affected. And then you lose 50 cents to the dollar. So you're still going to be... Obviously, you're going to be better off if you can work and earn a decent wage. So... You know, everyone will still receive the pension.
Is that right across the whole board, or is that just here in Victoria?
No, it's right across Australia. There's over 20,000 workers in these ADEs that are impacted by these assessments. So there's 10,500 who are assessed under BSWOT around Australia, I think.
I had one question. I'm Tom Maxwell, and I'm with Job Support. One of my friends are in Job Support. I was just wondering, does Job Support and other job agencies come under, like, where to find a job?
No, Job Support is... they assist people find work in open employment usually. Occasionally they'll find work for their clients in ADEs, but it's not the usual practice.
It actually is, because a lot of the people from Job Support do work under this heading where they get supported wages, and their wages are actually capped at a certain level, and then they get the pension on top. My ex-husband is under this wage at the moment.
Right. Supported wage is different to BSWOT. Supported wage is a straight productivity wage assessment, and that is used in open employment. Now, the disability employment services, they assist people with disability find work in, usually, as I said, in open employment. That's what their contract says. However, they do assist them in some employees go to ADEs, but it isn't the usual practice. So there's a difference between in an ADE, you're allowed to pay the employees under BSWOT or another 28 different assessment tools. One of those is a supported wage. What we say is that the only tool that should be used if you're going to assess people's wages is a supported wage system because it's straight productivity. So, sorry. Oh, hang on a minute. I think I've gone too far. I think I leant on it. Yeah. So I told you, I'm really...
Just one? Another one?
No, that's one.
Yep. This one? Yep.
Right. So why we say BSWOT is discriminatory? Because it's not based on the comparison of actual work at the award level. It includes an assessment of competencies which are irrelevant to the job. Workers with and without disability in open employment and in receipt of full award wages don't have their wages discounted by reference to competencies. So, you know, you go to work, if you're working in open employment, you go to work and you're paid a wage. You don't lose a percentage of your wage if you don't know what to do if there's a fire drill, which is what happens for these workers in ADEs. Workers without disability doing the same award level of work would not achieve, on average, 100% wage assessment if assessed under BSWOT. And that was what the court found. And it understates the value of the actual work contribution of all employees, particularly with an intellectual disability. And the competencies element of it was they set the bar too high for supported employees. They were assessed on things that they didn't actually do. So, for example, setting up the production line. Those were jobs that the supervisors did. And so why should they lose a percentage of their wage because they didn't actually do a job? Well, for example, Gordon Pryor, who was one of the applicants in the original action, he was visually impaired, or is visually impaired, I should say. He can't fill the lawnmower with petrol because he can't see to do so. But he lost a percentage of his wage. He was never employed to do that element of the job. So the difficulty with this tool is that people were losing percentage of their wage for things that they didn't do. So we put in a complaint to the Australian Human Rights Commission.
I work in Sydney and I work with FACTS. I was wondering what if... people with disability adjust work placement in a government job. How do you do that?
I'm not quite sure what you mean. If you're working in open employment, do you mean working in open employment for the government?
Yes.
All right. If you, well, it's really up to your employer as to whether you go through the supported wage system. Most employees in open employment are employed on award wages. It's only sometimes when you're going through a disability agency, it may be that it's decided to assess you under the supported wage, and then what happens is that the assessor comes in and they do an assessment, and there's a comparison between somebody else working with you, and then they work out what the percentage of the wage that employee is going to receive. And that's got to be done every year. And it has to also go through the Fair Work Commission to make sure that it is fair. So there's quite a process before you can actually reduce wages in open employment. So we had two applicants, Michael Nogin, or his mother took the action on his behalf, and Gordon Pryor. Michael was from Coffs Harbour and Gordon was from Stall Interchange he worked for. And Justice Butte... In the first instance, so we went to the federal court first, we lost. And I just found that unbelievable. I thought how anyone looking at this tool or hearing about it could say that it was okay. And the judge said, well, you know, it's hard working with people with disabilities and it's a charity, so therefore it's okay. So obviously, you know, we didn't agree with that decision, so we appealed to the full court, the federal court. And by majority, we were successful. And Justice Buchanan said that, you know, that the criticism was compelling. He couldn't see why it was the competencies were part of an assessment tool. And he actually went on to say further that any tool that had competencies as an element of it should not be used to assess people with intellectual disability for their wages. So in his view, the BSWOT was unreasonable. Well, the government didn't like that, so they went to the High Court, or they sought leave to appeal at the High Court. And the High Court was unanimous in their decision, and they confirmed the majority's decision, and they rejected the application. And again, the judges there couldn't see why this tool should be allowed. Now, the government didn't accept that decision, and which is really unfortunate, obviously. So their response was, I'll just flick this over. They had a vision for supported employment, future wage setting arrangements, discussion paper. And, you know, all right, we've got that discussion paper. Unfortunately, there wasn't much discussion with a lot of people about it. There was a consultation with the disability sector. We had discussions with the employer groups, families, advocacy organisations, other interested parties, and last of all, the employees themselves. Now, the employees themselves didn't have, advocates weren't allowed to be present. It was very much a presentation done by the department, and questions, obviously, of what we should do. And that was it. That was in July last year. So we had the High Court decision on 10th of May last year, 2013. A couple of months later, we have a consultation, and that's it. And then during the caretaker period, the department put in an application to the Australian Human Rights Commission for an exemption, so that they could continue using BSWOT for another 3 years. So we've been using it, 10 years now, and they wanted another 3 years. They haven't done anything yet. People are still being paid under BSWOT. There are people who haven't been assessed at all. So we've had very, very little consultation, or certainly not with the advocacy sector and with the employees themselves that we can work out in regards to the employees, but there has been consultation with the ADEs. The Commonwealth does not consider BSWOT discriminatory. That they see that the decision only applies to the particular circumstances of Michael Nogent and Gordon Pryor, which is really surprising when you consider Justice Buchanan said for all employees with intellectual disability. So since then, we have a complaint was put into Australian Human Rights Commission, which has now ended up in the federal court. It's a representative action. It's been taken, as I said, Tyson, who you saw the photo of, he's taken that action on his own behalf and on behalf of all those employees with intellectual disability working in ADEs who have been assessed under BSWOT. This action seeks to recover all underpayments for the affected workers. The government's response. They announced plans for a business services wage assessment tool payment scheme, but the catch was that they had to waive all their legal rights to be eligible. The minister announced that this scheme was not to be taken as compensation. On the 29th of April, we got a decision from the Australian Human Rights Commission. They granted a temporary exemption for the ADEs to continue using BSWOT for a further 12 months. Now, this was subject to some conditions, and those conditions were that they had to report every 3 months. They had to transition out of BSWOT. Now, 29th of July was the first 3 months. There's been no report. from either the government or from the ADEs. The National Disability Services, which is the peak body representing ADEs, describes the decision as reprehensible. And they have made an application to the Australian Administrative Tribunal to have that decision reviewed. Difficulty with that is that that takes time, so we're looking at a hearing for that in February, March of next year, nearly 12 months after the initial decision. But they have to continue doing the conditions, following the conditions, which, as I said before, they haven't done so. Now, so whilst the Human Rights Commission decision foreshadows an end to BSWAT, it obviously hasn't been accepted by the government or the peak body. What we say here is that, you know, the decision by the Australian Human Rights Commission, but also by what has been happening, is you have to question the authority of Australia's legal system. Further, there's application in Fair Work Commission to vary the award. We've got, we had on the 5th of June this year, the government introduced legislation into the House of Reps. This bill was introduced to effectively put the scheme into legislation. Only two members of the House of Reps voted against it. Adam Brand, and Andrew Wilkie. The rest voted for a scheme that we would say is discriminatory. It then went to the Senate. The Senate has referred it to a Senate inquiry. Submissions were called for, obviously put in, and the week before last there was a public inquiry where I went to give evidence. It was really interesting. I obviously stayed for the... It was only a morning was given. One of the questions to the... Well, the government was given a number, or the department, a number of questions, but they made it very clear that they do not accept this decision. As I said before, it only applies to Michael Nogin and Gordon Pryor. The other thing that came out was that the intention of this scheme, which we disagree with the legislation, we believe that it should not go through, was that only those employees who have listed as their primary disability as being intellectual disability will be eligible. So Gordon Pryor, who is visually impaired, he has an intellectual disability. He would not be eligible under the scheme. Michael Nogin, cerebral palsy, that is his primary disability. He's not eligible under the scheme. So we're obviously appealing to the senators not to allow it to go through. There was a report by the Parliamentary Joint Committee on Human Rights, and, you know, they had it right. This legislation should not be passed. I'm not going to go into it too much detail because probably time's over. But what the scheme actually effectively does, they're saying that they will pay 50 cents to the dollar of what people are owed. They're also saying that the secretary, who has a conflict of interest because he is... the department is the respondent, obviously, in the matters, the legal matters that are going on, can appoint a nominee to stand in the shoes of the employee. Effectively, that employee has no rights. If the nominee says accept the money, you accept the money. And they are not able to continue with their legal action. So I'll just skip those. What was said by Josh Bornstein, who's the principal at Maurice Blackburn, is that it's a blatant attempt to coerce some of our most vulnerable workers into signing away their legal rights for a sum of money that is just half of what they should be paid. And where does this leave us? Where does the Australian Constitution and separation of powers fit? We've got the executive, we've got the parliament, and we've got the legal system, yet we've got the government not abiding by the decision, where any other respondent or any other person who does not win their case is expected to abide by the law. Why shouldn't the government? Is this the end of the of employment for this group of workers within ADEs? To return to the Dark Ages, we've dragged them out of the Dark Ages to get them recognised into employment, and yet what's happening is, and what the intention is quite clear, is that the government intends to legislate the new tool, and that was during one of the speeches, so that the tool will be enshrined in legislation and therefore very difficult to challenge. We don't need a new tool. What's wrong with the supported wage system? And how we see it is that despite the fight, 12 years later, employees with disability working in ADEs are still being shortchanged. Okay, so has anyone got any questions? I know it's past.
Before these changes for next year, what's going to be happening with the people that are on DSP? If we, do we have to go look for jobs or...?
Hold on. That's something different to what I've been talking about. But my understanding is that what you have to do is every 3 months you go to... you have an appointment with Centrelink, and you then Centrelink, the person that you speak to at Centrelink, will help you draw up your goals. And part of that is your goals to find employment. It might be, looking at what... I went to one the week before last and they wanted to know what... not just what the employment goals were, but what goals that you might have for other activities as such. You know, do you want to join the local gym? You know, all things like that. That's the sort of questions that my client was asked. But, yes, the aim is to try and find employment, from what I can understand.
Hi, this is Karen. It's a question for you and actually for the previous speaker as well. I just wondered, these systemic advocacy matters that you've taken up, I'm not sure if you call them public interest matters or law reform matters or what have you, I just wondered how you came to take up these matters by each of your services?
All right. As I said, about 12 years ago, I attended a few meetings where there was a lot of talk about, you know, well, we should be doing something about these, you know, what people are being paid in business services as they were then. And I thought, you know, we really shouldn't just be talking, we should be doing something. And so we started fighting, we intervened in the National Wage case, and then it's sort of grown from there. But I really did believe when we got that decision from the High Court that that would be the end, that all the next step would be working out what people are owed. Instead, there's about four or five different actions going on. The government has spent so much money and, you know, just legal fees alone that into the millions that we're talking. We don't obviously get any of that because we're funded by the same department. We've had our funding threatened by them in relation to it. But I... you know, to see every step of the way you just is a fight. You know, even in the representative action, they are challenging the definition of intellectual disability, which is incredible. I mean, you know, they're the ones who write the legislation for, you know, for Centrelink and so forth. So why should they be challenging something as you know, like that? But, you know, it doesn't matter which way you go, it's challenged. Everything's challenged.
In relation to our action, Villamanta Disability Rights Legal Service predominantly works with people with intellectual disabilities, and if the intellectual disability affects the legal issue or the legal issue affects the disability, that's the first step of us taking a matter on. What we then do is try to find a way of asking ourselves the question, is this a significant issue that needs to be addressed? Clearly, in the case of the rent increase, it was a significant issue. Third one, of course, is emotional blackmail. People ring us up and say, please help me. And sometimes the squeaky wheel does make a difference. In our case, of course, it was of significant importance that people's rights were defended. And as Kirsty has just said, there is an issue of funding. As I said, in our case, of course, we were up against QCs, and it was just me arguing against. And by the way, there were three of them, and it was just me and another lawyer sitting on the other side of the table just to pass documents. So in answer to your question, in both answers really are, we try to find something which has a significance to the client group, and then we try and work out what we can to assist.
So just to add to that, you know, and as we've said, the resources are, you know, we've got two lawyers and we've got 350 clients, so we've got a whole lot of other matters that we've got to deal with. The resources that are put into these fights are huge. And, I mean, we were lucky we've had Holding Redlich come in on the first matter and now we've got Maurice Blackburn. But we're the ones who deal with the clients. It's, you know, it is so important, and I think what happens is that you end up living it, breathing it. It's just become so much part of you.
We do our submission writing at midnight, if we're lucky.
Yes. There
was a question here.
I was just wondering if you had a view about this. I noticed in both of your speeches there was a definite move for attitudinal change and social change, but there seems to be a lot of resistance in the minds of politicians and getting that political change to happen and running those political campaigns. Is there I don't know if either of you have a view on this, a need for self-advocates to start moving and start thinking about becoming more, I guess, political lobbyists?
Can I just answer in regards to that? I actually don't believe it's the government here. It's the department. We've had a change of government. We haven't had a change of attitude. We've got the same department heads, the same department managers, and they're the ones who are having the influence. I mean, as I said, you know, putting in the application for an exemption during the caretaker mode, you're not meant to do that. But it was done, and so I think that, you know, unfortunately what we've got is a very, for some reason they are determined to fight this on every, you know, we weren't lucky enough for the government to walk away and say it's okay. It comes down to, and I don't understand why people can look at it and think it's okay, because you could be sure that if they were affected by it, if they had to lose part of their wage or they were paid such a pittance, that they would not. And Gordon Pryor said to the judge in the first instance, "You wouldn't work for $2 a day, so why should I?" And he's right.
Sorry, ask half a dozen lawyers a question, you'll get half a dozen different answers. I actually agree that in some ways it is the department. In the case that we were running, it was against the Department of Human Services in Disability Services, and there is a barrier in dealing with DHS. In this case, however, it was significantly a change in government with a more libertarian political view than the previous governments, and it was the drive of the minister to want to push disability accommodation services into the private sector, which drove this case. So a bit of both, I think. Oh, yes, to your question, should people become more political advocates? Absolutely.
I'd like to thank Kirsty Wilson from AED Legal Centre for her presentation. That was fantastic. Thank you. And thank you again, Viv Avery from Villamanta Disability Rights Legal Service. And if you don't have any more questions, we might as well sort of wind up, but we're happy to take more questions. Sort of, I'm sure the speakers would. Oh, there's one question in the second row from the front. We'll just wait till you get the microphone. And I'll just show you the book. We have a few copies if you would like a book on how to do a community lobbying campaign about an important matter.
This one's for Kirsty. Do all ADEs have to follow this tool? And if they don't, is there some way that companies wanting to use them can find out whether they pay a more ethical wage?
Sorry, I won't climb back up there. Look, B-SWOT is gone. They're not allowed to use it now at all. There are other tools that they obviously can use. There's listed in the award for ADEs. It's a bit confusing. You said AED. We were AED before they became ADEs. Under this award, there's 30 tools that can be used. Now, we haven't challenged the other 29, but they all have elements of competency. Our argument would be that they are not allowed to be used either. However, that's a battle yet to come. The supported wage is also listed in the award, and that's the one that can be used. But what they're saying is that if they use the supported wage system, it will, the viability of ADEs will be in question. Now, we've seen no financial evidence. We realise that there will be some that will have an impact. However, they've presented no financial documents or, you know, evidence to show that they will not be able to operate. So, did I answer your question?
If you're in a company that wants to ensure it's giving a contract to an ethical provider, is there any way you can find that out or any questions you should ask?
All right, sorry, I misunderstood the question. So that's if you want them, you know, for example, to pack your muesli bars. Yeah, you can. You can ask them how they pay the wages. You've got a right to know. We found it difficult to find out who is paying under which wage tool, although we know from that there's, you know, more than half of them have been using BSWAT. And the reason that they've used BSWAT is that the government, because they designed it, they also paid for the assessors to go out and do the assessment. But supported wage is another one because it is owned by the government as well. They also, if they go out and do the assessments, wouldn't have to pay for it. But, yeah, I think there are questions that certainly private companies should be asking is because, you know, it's certainly a big thing. You know, we don't, anything that, you know, if people aren't, you know, the slave labour, that sort of thing, because that's effectively what it is.
Thanks, Kirsty. Just one little PS from Viv, because maybe one more question, and then Viv will just briefly speak about the issue of is there a better way, and, you know, have we learnt something so that next time we'll do things differently. So if we could just have that one question, and then we'll hand over to Viv, and then we'll wind up and have lunch. Thanks, everyone.
Kirsty, a question for you again, sorry. In relation to the BSWAT, you just said that that's no longer in use or not meant to be used, correct?
Well, with the exemption that they were given, they were granted 12 months. So nobody, no new employees can be assessed by it. They have to be assessed by either supported wage or another tool. They are still paying under BSWAT for 12 months. So by the 29th of April next year, nobody should be being paid under BSWAT at all.
All right, thank you.
Okay, one of the objectives of this session was for us to give a talk and then to discuss from the floor, is there a better way? We don't have a lot of time, unless there's some suggestions to come from the floor, is there a way we could have done it better? From our perspective, I think Kirsty did an absolutely brilliant job in the access in the matter that she was running. From our perspective, I thought we did a fairly good job. There were things we didn't do. We didn't have a coordinated effort to bring all the streams together, that is the political, the social and the legal. We ran off and did our own thing. Valid did one, we did the other. And that would have made a significant difference. We didn't use social media as much as we possibly should have done. And social media would have been very effective, particularly a targeted social media campaign. And irrespective of the fact that we're lawyers and we like to look at things in the law, just to give an example, when we ran the jurisdiction argument, the jurisdiction argument was 2 days on the difference between and or. And I found that absolutely fascinating, and you probably wouldn't. Lawyers look at things differently to normal people. It means lawyers aren't normal. But the social campaign would have made a huge difference because it would have been out there. It would have been a pressure. What Graham said earlier on about one letter, one visit to the politicians is absolutely true. So had we been more coordinated, we possibly would have done slightly differently. That's just my addition. Thank you.